Anshakalpa Trubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyeva Japatitaram Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So today we have reached 11:37. You remember that Yogendra named Pipalayana is answering the question of Maharaj Nimi as to the nishtam, the situation, the condition of that which is known as Narayana, as Brahman, and as Paramatma. And so the answer has been given these different verses first of all, in 35, that from which everything, basically Bhagavan, Brahman, and Paramatma are explained in one verse each. And at the end of the text 40, there's a quotation from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati who points out that these verses follow the sequence of a standard way that scholastic way that argumentation is presented. So this text 35 is the Vishaya, the subject or the thesis that this is what Brahman is. Then after that, the next text, which then goes on to talk about how this Brahman cannot be conceived by the mind, characterized by words and speech and so on, a completely negative description, almost. And that has the kind of function of the shamshaya, the doubt. Can you really know Narayana? That's in text 36. So text 37 is in this categorization the Purva Paksha, the opposing side. And Mona Williams, Purva Paksha is translated as the first objection to an insertion in any discussion. So there's the assertion that Brahman is not conceivable, perceivable, understandable, knowable, and so on. And so this is the other side. And the other side is, in this verse, Brahman is manifest everywhere in a variety of ways. And so basically in this text is an inventory of the contents of the material world, you could say, huh? So let's look at this verse. First, sattvam rajastama iti trivrit ekam adau. So here's the kind of statement that this ekam, this one, of course, where Brahman is famously eka, without any second thing, adau, in the beginning, it says here before creation, originally, is one. Trivrit is threefold, a triad. And this well-known triad, mode of goodness, mode of passion, mode of ignorance, sattvam rajas tamah iti. So that's how this Brahman is now, things that we recognize, the mode of goodness, passion, and ignorance. And then sutram mahan aham iti. Again, like this threefold, another threefold. Pravadantim, they say, is called, or they say. Usually when they say, they mean authorities say, not just anybody, the man in the street, but authorities, they say. And then this sutram mahan and aham, that is to say, the sutram here means the power to act, the power of consciousness, and aham, the sense of ego. This another kind of development out of the modes of nature or form of them. How does we say here? Yes, yeah, so this, if you look at the translation, originally one, the absolute Brahman comes to be known as threefold, manifesting self as the three modes of material nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance. Brahman further expands his potency, that's the connecting, and thus the power to act and the power of consciousness become manifest along with false ego. Again, you see that's kind of goodness, passion, and ignorance. False ego being ignorance, consciousness being goodness, power to act being passion. Which covers the identity of the conditioned living being. That's the jivam. And then jnana, kriya, artha, phala, rupataya, oru, shakti. So then it goes on. There's this thing here, jnana, kriya, and artha. And you see in the Jnana, the demigods as the embodiment of knowledge. We'll go back to this. This shows up in the second and third canto. This kind of description of the ingredients. Kriya, there's Jnana Shakti, Kriya Shakti, and here the powers of the senses of action, doing. Kriya means doing, and then here Artha. Artha means a sense object. But this is also called Dravya Shakti. So again, a triad. And then it's add, and Phala, the fruits of these things. Here is described usually happiness and distress. That's another manifestation. Rupataya, assuming the forms, Uru Shakti, possessing varieties of energies. So here the word shakti, which is a very important word in this context, the varieties of energies, Brahma eva bhati. Brahma, the Supreme alone, is manifest in this way. And then sadasatcha, the gross objects and their subtle causes. I think we may have mentioned this sadasat, which means real and unreal, but generally, the asat is referred to causes because they're asat because they're not manifest. You don't see them. Causes are subtle, but sat, the effects are evident. So sadasat means the material causes affected in this world. Or sadasat, everything in this world, sadasat cha tayo of both of them param yat. It is that which is transcendent or beyond both of this. So this is Brahman now. All these things. He's the connected to Sadasat in a way, because he's the cause of all of the cause of all causes. So these are the different elements of the universe. Jnana, Kriya, and Bala. If you want to go back and look at this in the Bhagavatam, second canto, chapter 5, like starting with verses 19 going through 24, and there in the text in the purport, I think the text is like in 24, Dravya Shakti, which is the powers that evolve matter, Kriya Shakti, the initiation that creates, and Jnana Shakti, intelligence that guides. So there are different ways of characterizing them. Adibhuta, Adiatma, and Adidaiva. So Adibhuta is the Dravya Shakti. In other words, the material elements, the gross material, the material elements, which come out of that mode of ignorance. If you remember the Sankhya, Adhyatma, Kriya Shakti, which means here the senses, and those senses come out of the mode of passion. And Adidaiva is Jnana Shakti, and the Devas, and this is the mode of goodness. So that's another development, this Drovya Kriya Jnana of the creation. So that's where that comes from. In many senses, this is everything that you see in this. These verses have already been presented elsewhere in the Bhagavatam earlier. So that's the threefold division. So now you can see why this is, well, here is the Brahman is visible in this way, because Brahman is that from which everything comes. And here, if you see in the first paragraph of the purport, Sridhar Swami is correctly quoted as and translated, karyam karanat binat binam cha nabhavati. The result is not different from the cause. This material world is also a manifestation of Brahman. I think in the purport to the next verse, Savam Klavidam Brahman, this is a Upanishadic statement. All this is in fact Brahman. So this is the other thing. This is very different from the previous verse. It's the opposite, which is Brahman is inaccessible, unknowable, understandable. So in this way. And here it said, you notice, Uru Shakti Brahmaiva Bhati. Brahman indeed manifests Uru Shakti. The great varieties of energies. So now we let's go through this purport here. You'll notice And in the first paragraph of the purport, a lot of this is against, of course, the Mayavad philosophy. The Mayavad philosophy, as I've mentioned before, what it really says is that Brahman has no energies. If you look at the Adi Lila, chapter 7, where Mahaprabhu is talking to the sannyasis at Benares, this is very clear that this is what Shankara says. He denies the energies of the Lord. And instead of saying everything, and as Mahaprabhu says, that Shankaracharya has suggested that Vyasadeva is wrong. He says that to the sannyasis at Benares. So this is the Mayavad philosophy. It denies the energies of the Lord. And so really the issue in this verse is, how is Brahman way out there, and how is it here at the same time? Because you have the Shakti and the Shaktiman. So what is the relationship between the Shakti and the Shaktiman? Because this relationship is difficult. And from Shankaracharya's point of view, inexplicable. The Shaktis are denied. The real mistake is to separate the Supreme from the Supreme's energies. So one way of doing it is just ordinary atheism. Here the Shaktis, they're real, there is no Shaktiman. They somehow pop out of nowhere, and they keep on going without anyone in control. They don't come from anything. Right? That's atheism. The Mayavad philosophy takes the opposite tack. The absolute truth is there, and the energies do not exist. If you would say to Shankaracharya, or well, maybe not him, but his followers. What is the relationship between this material world and Brahman? The real answer is there isn't any. It's only imaginary. That you think there is no relationship. So it's really funny, a monistic philosophy has the effect of being totally dualistic. And basically saying, you know, you shouldn't ask that question because these energies are not really there. They're an illusory superimposition on Brahman. They're not Brahman's energies. They're an illusion. If you ask the question, whose illusion, you've got a problem. Because it's not Brahman's illusion, because then illusion would be more powerful than Brahman. It's not the Jiva's illusion, because the existence of Jiva is a product of illusion. So you just get this free-floating illusion that doesn't belong to anybody. And actually, they have to say, it cannot be described as either existing, anirvachaniya, sata-sat anirvachaniya, cannot be described either as sat or asat. It's some weird place in between. That's how they have to deal with this problem. Of course, if you're totally enlightened and one with Brahman, the problem doesn't show up because it's not there. But you can see, I mean, really, this represents very clearly the teachings of the Upanishads, that there is a Brahman, and from that Brahman comes the world. But in the course of trying to deal with this issue of thinking about it, how does it happen, how does it go on, then there, and it's hard. See, from the point, if your idea of Brahman is something that's entirely impersonal, nirvishesha, without any concrete variegatedness in it, and if the effect is none different from the cause, then where does the variegatedness come from here? How can something that's totally homogeneous, without parts, without the same everywhere, produce a world that's full of all this variety? And that's really, and of course that's why when you really you speak about the world coming from Brahman, you always speak of Narayana, or the Lord, because Brahman is savishesha, with vishesha. That's Vaishnava understanding. Ultimately, that vishesha is there. In other words, they're interior varieties within Brahman also, such as Krishna, his devotees, the Vaikuntha world. It's all variegatedness. So that's why you see variegatedness also here. So the second paragraph, it just says, the first sentence, in this verse, the expansion of the material world from Brahman, the Absolute, is described. Okay, that's, you should know this. And then the third paragraph begins, the question may be raised, since Brahman is stated to be Ekam, or one, how does it become manifest in the innumerable varieties of the material world? So again, that states the issue. In the fifth paragraph, an interesting point is made. According to Srila Jiva Goswami, the word phalam, you know, that word is used there in the verse. The dravya, well, they said artha and jhana and kriya, phalam, the fruit. Jiva Goswami says that phalam can also be understood to mean purushartha swarupam, the actual form of the goal of life, the Lord Himself. So, if your activities are engaged in Krishna consciousness, that will be the result, is a vision of the Lord. And then from when we get to the sixth paragraph, Here it says Srila Jiva Goswami has given an elaborate explanation proving that the entire cosmic situation is the natural potency of the Lord. This is really important, and also the purport is confusing to me. And so I'm just going to explain to you as best I can what the issue really is. In the sixth paragraph, there's very interesting quotation saying, Sri Jiva quotes it from the Vishnu Purana, third chapter 131 and 132, where Maitreya says to Parashara Muni this statement, how are we to understand that Brahman, the Supreme Soul, is the executor of the creation, maintenance and destruction of the material world, katam, how, sargadi, kartuttam, how is he the maker of sarga and so on, creation, maintenance and destruction, when this Brahman is nirgunasya, without any qualities, aprameya, here immeasurable. It's sort of inscrutable. It's more like the sense of, in other words, you can't, whatever you say about it, it surpasses that, inscrutable. Yapi here says unembodied and amalatmanaha, free from any fault or any stain. So this is all, Brahman is like this. And so how does the word, I've already described this really issue, how does Brahman, who is like so transcendent and so one, and how does that Brahman produce the world? And so then there's a text which is quoted. This text is also quoted, by the way, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Although Prabhupada gives no purport to it there, it is translated there. It's Majjalila 2113. So in this text, And from what I can understand, this purport goes into all kinds of things about the pure logic and logical necessity. And I don't know what that. I mean, logical necessity means one thing in philosophy, and I'm not quite sure how it understands. But I understand the general point. And it's this: is that the relationship between what this verse says is that shaktaya sarva bhavanam, the potencies, sarva bhavanam means all beings. Like, so in this world, all beings have potencies of some kind, or they have powers. And that this, the powers of any being's powers are actually, it says, achintya jnana gochara, which is here it's translated as mere logic cannot explain how, and in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, achintya inconceivable jnana gochara, by the range of man's knowledge. The word gochara, let's take jnana gochara. Gochara means something like the scope or the range of something. You know that go means cow. And chara means to go, wander, or graze. So the place that cows graze, a pasture. So a pasture is a defined, limited piece of, that's a range or a, so when the jnana gochara means the here it's in the plural, the ranges of our knowledge is that's what it's talking about, achincha, inconceivable. In other words, if you take this this negation, so you say achintya, cannot be conceived, ajnana, cannot be known. You can't know it, and you can't understand it. So there's actually two things here. You can't figure out the relationship. You can't know the relationship. You can't understand the relationship, really, between the Shakti and the Shaktiman, the energies and the possessor of the energies. So here in this world, we see that things have powers and potencies. The example in the verse is pavaka and ushnata, fire and heat. Fire is the Shaktiman, and heat is the potency of the fire. So what is the relationship there? Heat and light. What is how do we conceive or do we understand of the relationship? And we're really thinking about one. Are they one thing or are they two things? And this is the achincha beta abeda tantra. You cannot think of it as one because there's a difference. If I'm standing some distance from the fire and getting warm, you can't say I'm burning up in the fire, right? So on the one hand, there's a difference. On the other hand, if you say, where does the fire and the heat, where does the fire stop and the heat begins, there's one. So you can't think of it as different. You can't think of it as one. Neither one is thinkable. That's achincha beta. You don't think of it as different, because that doesn't work. Don't think of it as non-different, because that doesn't work. So by a kind of inference, you have to say they're both. They're both different. How are they both different and not different? Well, you know, that's a little hard to figure out, maybe. Right. You can't do either one by this thing. So this is really what this verse is about. And you know, this is the relation. You see things here. So in the microcosm, there are things with their potencies, and in the macrocosm, with Brahman and everything, that same relationship. The objects here in the world, say the fire, is the Shaktiman, the possessor of the energy. But on the other hand, that fire itself is an energy of Brahman. So everything here is an energy of Brahman, but because of this relationship of what's so above here below, the resemblance is there. So this achintya beta abeda actually applies to everything. There's some places, of course, where these energies are entirely not even. I think if you look at anything far enough, you're going to find a problem with this. The only way I think that I mean, as far as combustion goes, modern people don't think of fire as a thing anyway. They think of it as a process, as a kind of a physical reaction. So it's all nothing but heat and light. It's not an element here. It's described as an elephant, but so as an element. But take magnetism. Take a piece of a magnet. It sits on your desk, and a little while away, far away from that, you have a piece of iron, and it moves across the desk and connects with the magnet. How does that magnet reach out, grab a hold of the iron, and pull it to it? A similar phenomena is gravitation, right? We find that big bodies in space have an attractive force on other bodies in space. So the moon is said in modern physics to orbit around the Earth and stay in that orbit because the Earth's gravitation pulls the moon. How does the Earth reach out and grab the moon, right? Really, nobody knows. People have say things like gravity waves. What is a gravity wave? You know, does anyone know what a gravity wave is? People don't really know. And then they start talking about curvature of space and all this other kind of things, you know. But that's all just to describe it in a consistent way. It doesn't really explain it. And ultimately, I think you'll find out that if you really look at the world and the things that have power, it's hard. It's hard to know how this does this. So the point of this verse seems to be some things that we can understand, that they happen. You have to accept them. You just have to accept them. If you have a theory, you have a theory. Something happens that doesn't fit your theory. One tendency is, if you really attach that theory, is to deny that it happens. Thomas Kuhn, who does the study of the history of science and how it works, the structure of scientific revolutions is called. He says that when scientists have a theory that they're all buying into and that works, and then something pops out that doesn't fit the theory, what they do, he says, is they just set it aside. The theory works for everything else. We can't explain this. And then there's a collective process of forgetting. And he says they put it in the anomaly closet. Something is an anomalous that doesn't fit. And he says revolutions happen in science when the anomaly closet gets so full you can't ignore it anymore, and somebody happens to open the door a little bit and the cascade of things come falling out and you just can't ignore it. And then, you know, they come up with a new theory to explain all the anomalies. But meanwhile, they are forgetting. There is great use made of this this observation of how science works by Sariputta Prabhu and Drutakarma in this book, Forbidden Archaeology. They just simply went and piled, you know, collected all the anomalies and did some research when once a history of the human race had been decided on by the biologists. There were many observations in the 19th century that didn't fit the theory, and there was a systematic historical thing to go back and look at them and find some way to doubt it. Yes, this looks like a modern skeleton, and it looks like in rock that's much, much older, but maybe it washed down in a water. In other words, they found every reason to doubt it. If you took that same rigor of doubting, you would have no evidence for anything at all, practically. They really had a double standard, very high standard of acceptance for things that didn't fit the theory, and a very low standard of acceptance for things that didn't fit the theory. This is actually what happens. And then you have to say, at least if you accept it as you're really a rational person, and you haven't built your career on a theory to which you're attached, you have to say, we don't know what happened. We just have no idea what went on. And we don't have a theory. Many people can't live without theories. So as far as this goes, it is simply a fact. That if you want to know how that this Brahman produces the world, it just happens. Because is there a Brahman? Is Brahman there? Is transcendence there? Yes. We have experience of the world. And there are people who also have experience of Brahman. Brahman, Paramatman, Bhagavan. They also have experience. In fact, it's better experience than experience of the world, because your experience of the world is often wrong, but those who have experience of Brahman have purified senses and purified minds, and the obstacles to the things that causes confusion here, attachment, fear, anger, modes of ignorance, mode of passion, are not in those people. So actually, their knowledge is actually more reliable. And so anyway, that's the brunt of this, the thrust of this discussion about Brahman. So there is a way to know Brahman also, of course. There is Shabda Brahman, and you can find it out. So I think this is the idea of this this text that. At least from the point of view from impersonal Brahman, it becomes, to me, it becomes more understandable if you understand that there's variety in Brahman, that this the idea that Brahman is totally, is near Vishesha. This is Shankaracharya's philosophy, this, without variety. Also in the purport is mentioned Buddhism as another philosophy. That particularly when they say shunya, shunyavada, the teachings of shunya, that's not just Buddhism in general. That's a particular doctrine of Buddhists. If people say to you, you know, what do you think about Buddhism? You have to say there's a billion Buddhisms, and so you should say, what do you mean by Buddhism, and then deal with that. But just don't answer about Buddhism or anything like that. So this, there was before Shankaracharya, there was a Buddhist philosopher named Nagarjuna, and he belonged to the Madhyamika community of Buddhists, and he's the author of the Shunyavada. Particularly the Shunyavada philosophy. And there is good scholarly evidence, I've looked at it myself, that Shankaracharya's Mayavada philosophy is a translation of Nagarjuna's Shunyavada into Vedic terminology. Scholars who are not inimical to either of those two have noticed this. The Padma Purana, this Mayavadi philosophy, is called closet Buddhism, covered Buddhism, and the Mayavadis are really upset about that, because you know, if you're a Hindu, Buddhism is a heresy. But the scholarly evidence that that's exactly what Shankaracharya does, on a point-by-point basis, mapping the one on the other, you can see exactly how he did it. And there's either other evidence that there was some, that he had studied with Buddhists before. But anyway, that's there too. So that's not I don't think it's a calumny, just a personal attack on Shankaracharya. It's really a historical fact. And so here what we are getting really is dealing with the actual teachings of the Upanishads. Some of the things you have to accept. In the Upanishads, the Absolute Truth is described in many passages as impersonal, and other equally valid texts described as a person. What do you do? The principle of hermeneutical principle is you have to say, well, somehow or other they're both true. And so the really effort is to reconcile these things. You see how the Bhagavatam does it and how we accept them both as true and both as transcendental. What Shankaracharya does is demote the personal to pradhana. The personal is really arises out of the mode of goodness. There is material. That's the Mayavada. It's a product of illusion. So he demotes the personal out of transcendence, really. So I think that's the defect of this, and that the Vaishnavas have a way of at least saying both are valid manifestations. All three of these are valid manifestations of Brahman. So this is our little exercise in Vedanta for the day. I don't really have any time to go on to the next verse. The next two verses, just to preview a little bit, we won't be meeting next Sunday because I'll be traveling overseas. I think it's too hard to arrange. The next two verses really talk about the jiva, Brahman as in a way as manifest in the state of the jivatma, and then we'll come to the end of this section. Okay, so let me switch to the question and answer mode. And in the question and answer mode, if you want to ask a question, you have to press *6 to unmute your phone. Because here in the presentation mode, you don't have that option. It won't work, but in the Q&A mode, it will work. So let me do this. So as you want to be heard, you unmute yourself. And remember, Brahman is not inexpressible by words. You want to be mute.
Guru?
Yeah, hold on a second. Oh. We have one question already.
Oh, I didn't hear. Sorry, I was hitting the button. Sorry.
Are you speaking or not? What happened? I don't know.
Guru Maharaj, you're not talking to me, are you?
Well, you said Guru Dave, and then I thought...
Oh, okay. Yeah. I do have a question. I just thought that I thought you had just said to me you had another question, and
I did. But go ahead. You've got the floor now.
I'm sorry, but I have the floor quite a bit. I can wait.
Okay. Okay. Well, then we have a question from the studio audience. It's from Piyush Prabhu. Go ahead. You have to speak into the phone so that others and.
So my question is. In the process of devotional service, in the process of chanting Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, do you realize impersonal Brahman? Do you get to a platform of impersonal Brahman, or you just develop love for God? And the fact that everything is one, do you come to that realization? Is that making sense?
I, Of course, when there's Bhagavan realization, there's included Brahman realization and Paramatma realization. From what I can understand, it doesn't necessarily. In fact, for most devotees, you don't go through Brahman realization in the sense of losing your identity and being one with everything, and having your own sense of self disappear and your own. It's included in. So Brahman realization has certain effects. It's not that it's just Brahman realization in the sense that it obliterates Bhagavan, but it's Brahman realization in the sense of what is it? Prasanatma na sochati na kanchati sarva saveshu bhuteshu. You know, you see all living beings as one. You are totally joyful. You see everything as spiritual, but it's not that varieties disappear. So Brahman is a quality. The Brahman realization thought of as realization of kevala dvaita Brahman, of simply oneness without any variety, this does not usually happen to a devotee. In the Isha Upanishad, Brahman is described as Haranmayena Patrena, as a kind of golden globe or pot, right? And then you ask, pray to the Lord to remove the covering that hides your face. So other people who aren't directly initially engaged in the path of devotional service, but have been Brahmavadis and have this experience of oneness, they can pray like that to see the face of the Lord that is veiled or covered by the effulgence of Brahman, because they know he's there. Gyanavam mam prapajyate. So you become a gyani. You see all the things. You on Brahmabhuta prasanatma na sochati na kanchis sama sarveshu bhuteshu. You see all this. And then you can also go to the position of devotional service. But if you start off as a practitioner of pure devotional service, remember, you can be on the path of pure devotional service without yet being a pure devotee, but you're on that path. The Brahman or liberation is described as a side effect. It's just something happens by the way. And liberation means you're on the Brahmabhuta platform. You see that everything is situated in Brahman. The classic place for me for the statement of how everything is in Brahman and one with Brahman is becomes that way is in Bhagavad Gita 4:24, where a sacrifice is described, and how when sacrifice is performed, everything becomes Brahman. The offering, the butter, the fire, the offerer, the activity itself, the result of the activity, they're all Brahman. And so Prabhupada uses this, generalizes a little bit from a specific ritual of Agnihotra Yajna to the general principle of sacrifice, meaning dedicating all one's work to Vishnu, and then how everything in this way becomes one in Brahman. And so these varieties are also there. The material world is described there as the energy of Brahman. So what is the difference between matter and spirit? Well, there's one definition that we use, material things are temporary, the spirit is eternal, material things are unconscious, spirit is conscious. And we distinguish in this world between the jiva and the body of the jiva, between the knower and that which is known. The knower is spiritual, what is known is material. That's a good distinction. But the other distinction is that spirit means, or Brahman means, having a relationship to Krishna, the energies of Brahman. There's no difference between the cause and the effect. Then they both have to be Brahman. Right? So actually everything is Brahman. What is matter? Prabhupada describes it there, it is Brahman covered by illusion, maya, or sense gratification. So there is things covered. So the material world is Brahman. It's, and therefore real. But what we see, as long as the false ego is there, thinking oneself the enjoyer, being a competitor with Krishna, we will not see the world as it is. We will see something else. So I had this, I've told this story many times before, because it was when I was with Prabhupada in New Vrindavan, and there was a group of us, people from the Bhaktivedanta Institute, actually, and having a walking through the woods, and Prabhupada began to discuss how everything is spirit. And he used the example of wood and fire. That wood is actually just fire in another form. The tree takes the sunlight, grows wood, and so it's in the form of wood. But if you ignite the wood, again the fire comes out. So the fire is, wood is also fire, says like that. So in the same way, everything is actually spirit. And I had a kind of a crisis because I was really trying really hard to understand I'm not the body and the difference between matter and spirit, and then Prabhupada says everything is spirit. So I've, you know, got my courage together and presented this to Prabhupada that I'm trying to understand the difference between matter and spirit, and now you're saying everything is spirit. So I'm confused. And he said to me, his first thing he said was, we are not Mayavadis. He said, and then he said, there are different kinds of spirit. So that's the ultimate answer. There are different kinds of spirit. And so, in other words, the material world is also spirit, but it's spirit in a way that you can be confused. You can be bewildered. If you're in the internal potency, that bewilderment is not possible. But almost by definition, this is a logical truth. As soon as you become confused, you're in the material world. So that's why Prabodhananda Saraswati says that when you receive the mercy of Lord Chaitanya and fully in Krishna consciousness, the whole world becomes as good as Vaikuntha. For us, there's no practical difference. It's Krishna's kingdom. Krishna is everywhere. And so a devotee is not even eager to not take birth again because, of course, you will notice if you're a devotee that people are suffering. Are they really suffering? No. But like a person having a nightmare, they think they're suffering, and you wake them up. And then they'll see, yeah, the whole world is as good as Vaikuntha. So there's some compassion there, and obviously it's not as good as Vaikuntha for everyone, but one who's actually Krishna conscious, it is. That's my understanding. Okay? All right, we seem to be temporarily satisfied anyway. Not about you. Everybody always thinks of something more. Anyone else? Ma Mooney? You now have permission.
Thank you, Gumarsh. I have a question. I first have a brief comment, if I may.
Yes, you may.
It seems to me that this instance of this question of a relationship between something and its potencies seems to me to be a an instance of a broader issue which has plagued philosophers since time immemorial, which is the relationship between a thing and its properties. And so it's very hard for philosophers who
That's
believe
true.
That...
That's true, yeah. I understand the similarity, yeah.
And so it seems to me that that's an easy way for me to see how this Achintya beta-beta relation applies to everything.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you want to say something's different from its properties, but you strip all the properties away, there's no way to even think of the thing you're talking about.
Yeah, there's just this empty substance, right?
Yeah, a so-called bare particular, something weird like that.
Bare particular? Which nobody's ever seen, right? Particular always come with clothes on them, right?
Exactly. So I think, to me, that's a nice way to kind of see how this does apply everywhere. That, you know, anyway, sorry, I'm just throwing that out.
Yeah. I wonder if what's meant by shaktis is really equivalent to what you mean by properties. I wonder. But that's a question for you. There's your doctoral dissertation.
Well, maybe it'll be an appendix, kind of halfway through.
Okay. I'd be interested to see if that's what they really mean.
Yeah, and I'd like to try to explore that. My question is, it wasn't entirely clear to me how you were explaining what Achintya Beta Beta Tattva means today.
Mm-hmm.
There was a couple ways that I understood it from hearing, and please let me know how I misunderstood or how I did understand or whatever. First, you had this, I never heard this before, but I really liked it, the idea that both Beta alone is Achintya. It doesn't make sense. You can't really grasp it. And Abheda is Achintya.
Yeah, this is what Dvijamani told me, that Jiva Goswami's explanation of Achintya Beta Beta Tattva.
Okay.
Dvija, are you on the phone? He may have had to go. His wife just had he was here and his wife, you know.
I'm here, Gurdiv.
Oh, you are. So why don't you insert this? Why don't you answer this question?
Well, yeah, Jiva. That's precisely it. Jiva Goswami talks about it as saying that. It seems to me that Jiva Goswami speaks of this not as a chincha beta beta, but a chincha beta a beta. So that it's not that there's a both and it's inconceivable, but that either one is not conceivable, and therefore you have to. He brings up this idea of postulation, as it's sometimes translated, arthopathy. Since neither one of the normal available options will work, you have to postulate a third option, which is both. And therefore you get beta beta. This is tied in very, just as Mahamuni Prabhu was saying, this is tied into the whole notion of not just Shakti Shakti Man Bhava, but also Guna Guni Bhava, the relationship between the Guna and the possessor of the Guna, or the Dharma Dharmi Bhava, the Dharma and the possessor of the Dharma.
Wow.
Thanks.
Very good. Okay.
But
is your illusion now dispelled?
Well, not yet, because my question was about... So there was another way that you were elucidating the point, though, by examples from the history of contemporary science.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't sure exactly what you were doing. I didn't know. Sometimes here's the mild skeptic in me is coming out, that I worry about arguments that say science is so weird nobody can understand it, because I kind of agree with that. But I think that when people like us say that, there's always going to be a scientist who's been researching this stuff for 30 years, and they'll say, oh, no, this is what it means to say that space is curved.
Well, I figured I was in safe company.
Well, okay, that's fine. but I tend to frequent places where that it wouldn't be.
Yeah, you can't do that. All I want to say is that this has been, magnetism and gravity are ongoing problems for scientists. Mm-hmm. And I think the nature of the case is that everything that I've seen to deal with them has, you know, it's all mathematical, and all you ultimately do is describe it, describe the relationships among things, exactly how it really works. You know, when you have a big body and there's a kind of distortion of space, it's almost like the moon being tracked to the Earth is like, when I've seen the graphs of it, you know, it's like, it looks like a ball rolling downhill.
Yeah.
Like,
sure.
It's sort of, so yeah, now I understand it, but I don't understand it, because, I mean, this is math, pure mathematics, and I just use that as an example just to say that if you get into it, and I think you did a better job of it, everything is inconceivable. There's some things that are more obviously inconceivable than other things. But I to me, just gravity is so weird. Because what? How does it pull it? You know, my idea of, you know, force working on another force is you know, there's some, you know, if I want I have more gravity than the phone. I suppose there's a slightly invisible attraction, not powerful enough to move it. But if I were a bigger body, the phone would just automatically come to me. Right? It would, right? If I had more mass, I wouldn't have to be bigger. I'd just have to be denser, actually.
As long as there wasn't another thing with more mass around.
That's true. That's true. It had to be in outer space. That's true. Anyway, I don't know, but.
Behind my question, Gurumaraj, is that I don't know. Like, you know, do you notice the tone of this version of the Bhagavatam translation? It's very much an emotive chastisement.
Yeah, I'm not so happy.
It's a little bit embarrassing.
I understand that, right?
Because and the deep part is that I see devotees make arguments that could equally be made against them, and they wouldn't have, I think, a response that satisfies their criteria.
Yeah, right.
And so, not that I don't, and by all means, thankfully, I've never seen an iota of that kind of weirdness from you, and I'm grateful for it. But I just wondered if someone could say back to you, okay, you explain it, and then we would quote Shastra, and they'd say, well, you're not explaining the underlying mechanism, you're just claiming the brute fact. And so, yeah, we are.
Well, this whole verse is about how you just have to accept the brute fact, I believe. So we do that, too.
Okay, right. So in other words, though, is your complaint about the scientists that they claim to be doing more than we are, and yet they're doing the same thing?
Yeah.
Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's right. That's the idea.
Okay, thank you.
Hare Krishna Gurudev, if I could chime in just very quickly on that. The one thing that Jiva Goswami also did sort of mention, which I think kind of addresses part of Mahamuni's question, I think, is that in addition to being achintya, he also speaks about how the shaktis are sort of you can't undo them, you can't override them. I mean, he speaks about that in relationship to the heat of fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is at least something to be said for the idea that if you really understood in the way that, you know, just absolutely understood how something worked, you should be able to turn it off. And there is something, you know, there is something that Jiva Goswami says to the effect of, you know, which is actually this whole thing of what got sort of weirdly translated, but the original point about the mantras and jewels is that you can't use mantras and jewels to counteract the effect of the heat of fire. It will burn no matter what mantra you chant to try to get it not to burn you.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be that there is at least something to be said for the idea that if everything in the world is achintya in the sense that we can't completely understand it, you know, that is sort of one component of it, that no matter how well we can, as you said, describe gravity or the heat of fire or any of these things, you know, there may be some ways to sort of get around it, but you can't turn it off.
I'm not quite clear about what his point is about being able to turn it off.
Meaning that you couldn't cause fire not to be hot.
Right. Well, we always explain it as this dharma, then it wouldn't be fire anymore. That's almost true by definition, right?
Yeah.
Is the idea that knowing something completely means that you have a mastery of it, and that mastery should allow you to be able to control it, by modus tollens, you can't control it, therefore you'll never fully know it? Is that the idea? You're negating the conclusion, so you're negating...
Is that right? Is that what you mean? Is that what you mean?
Well, Jiva Goswami isn't making that argument. He's just saying that comparing the Lord's shaktis to the heat of fire and saying that there is no way to override them.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I just thought that there could be perhaps some relevance to Mahamuni's, you know, issue about the critique of people not understanding what they're claiming to understand is in that issue of being able to override the potency of something.
Yeah, okay. I understand that.
Thank you, Guru Maharaj. Thanks, Richard.
Okay. I think we've come to the end of our session. And so we will again convene together, I hope, October 12th. On the 12th of October, and we will now take the next verse, which is 38. Is that right? Yes, which is the Siddhanta. Hey, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.